many nerds, so many nerds is what I like. Inducting and dancing and dying around the mic. They interview cause they got guests and they will school you about comedy, comedy, ha, 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 ha. Comedy nerds, I wanna know all what they know. This is the comedy, comedy nerd show. Comedy, comedy, ha, ha, nerds, ha, ha. What's so funny, what's so funny, they tell you so. Ha, 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 nerds.
I just want to give everyone a warning. The last like week and a half, I discovered that on Hulu, they have a British comedy show called Peep Show. It's mm-hmm. like a sitcom, and about two guys who live in an apartment or whatever. Point is that I watched all six seasons in the last week and a half, and I've noticed that today I was out in the backyard doing something, and I screwed something up, and I went, oh, bloody hell. So I may be occasionally like sort of calling people gits and saying things like that, you know, talking about the monarchy and pounds and stuff like that. But I mean, it's really amazing that when you watch something like that, it really does start to affect you.
Right. So much so that you didn't even introduce yourself at the top of the show.
I know. Well, that's a very British thing to do.
It is.
They're very
right.
modest, and they don't want to do that. But I'll break that mold. I'm Dan McInerney.
I'm Dusty Adair.
We are the Comedy Nerds, and we are here with a guest this week, Dustin.
Yes, Carl Arnheider. I knew I was going to not say it fluently the first time.
That's totally the way
comedian
to say it.
And host of Inside Joke. If you're in the New York area, you've heard of Inside Joke. If you're in the comedy, know you've heard of Inside Joke.
Yeah, one of the best things around, wow. And that's not an ass-kissing thing. It's really fantastic. Oh, Carl, thank you so much for being on the show. This is an honor and a pleasure for me. Dustin doesn't really care, but I don't. I think your show is fantastic.
To be honest,
I think
you
you're
guys.
Fantastic. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, mate. That's really great of you and unexpected. Thank you.
It is rare to have a guest on your show that you hope to one day be interviewed by.
Mm.
Oh, wow. That's great. You guys can do the show.
Yeah.
You guys
we'll do
really
it.
Come on.
Yeah, that would be, and that would be a record-breaking show. Lowest audience attendance.
Not true.
I think only sound engineer would be.
And maybe my dad.
So
my mom's not going to
be. Maybe it's happening right now.
But yeah, it is kind of. In a way, this would be it.
Turn the tides on you guys.
Uh-oh.
All right, so getting into the news,
because mm-hmm.
we'll talk about all the other stuff later.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to it.
Getting into the news. The first item isn't really like a news thing, just we haven't really talked about it yet.
Nah.
And Carl and I just watched it before before Dan got here.
I can see your piece of paper. So now you're going to say, I have been trying to pretend like it's not happening.
Yes.
Kind of like an abused child,
yes.
just continuing to go into school and pretending like this is not happening.
And
but
what we are talking about is the Kilbourne file.
Mm.
Now, you may not have it in your particular market because they're testing it at different times in different markets. But the former host of The Daily Show, not when it was not with Jon Stewart, Craig Kilbourne, is hosting a show, at least in the New York market, at 7 o'clock. And it's really just his old Daily Show again.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to talk about it because we hadn't. And it's one of those things where the fact that we haven't talked about it says a lot about what it is. Because it's right in that, like, wheelhouse of things that we should be talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get your guys' opinion on what... What you think? Because I think it went wrong, and I wanted to see where you guys thought it went wrong.
Or right.
Maybe I'm just being negative.
I mean, I'll jump in. I'll give Carl a second to think, because I often talk without thinking. But I mean, I've watched precious little of it, just because I watched a few minutes of it and turned it off. It felt to me like, ironically, someone will probably talk about it a little later on, and not to pile on this person, but it felt like the Chevy Chase talk show, which was just like, it just, everything felt wrong about it. Like when I watched the Chevy Chase show, it just, you could see what they were trying to do and how it was just not working. And like you were saying, it was like it's just his version of the Daily Show, but now it's been like 15 years, mm-hmm. and so it looked like, you know, a football player who's now 15 years older, still trying to run down the field. And it's like, yeah I mean, I see how the vestiges of what you used to be, but this is just not, you know. And on top of everything else, at the time, The Daily Show was, you know, groundbreaking and amazing. Now, not only does The Daily Show still exist, but there's 20 other shows that are very similar to it. So why you're, you know, on, I don't know, what channel is it on? I don't even know. But
Fox.
Yeah, why you're on, like, the Jeopardy schedule of, like, in every city it's on at a different time just seems very, very strange to me, so.
They're testing it to see how it works.
Okay. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Carl?
Well, in the 2.5 minutes that you and I watched, and we actually watched 20 minutes in reverse. I will say I liked Kilbourne when he was on The Daily Show. I like it much better with Jon Stewart. But I thought Kilbourne at the time, he was, and maybe it was my age, like he was smug and he was really flip and he was like everything. I don't want to say, I mean, he was always like a frat guy, which I inherently don't like, but there was something about him. Like I liked his attitude about stuff. And I thought like, I like this guy. But then at some point, just like everybody else, I was like, I really don't like this guy. and then I just think I don't know what he hasn't done in the last 12 years since he left, but I think there are a lot more deserving people who should be in his floating time spot. That's my take on it. I unfortunately can't say anything about the show because I haven't seen it, but more than we saw tonight. But I did think in what we saw tonight, it did seem really cliche, and you spotted those punchlines coming from 2 seconds away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd read something this past week where someone was talking about not the rule of threes, but the rule of three thoughts,
mm-hmm.
where you need to, the first punchline you think of, is really obvious. The second one is, not that funny. The third one is good, and then the fourth one is too weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they went to the second one, or the first one, about every single time.
Somewhere between one and two. Yeah. Well, that's an improv rule, the rule of third thought. So you're always discarding those first two, and then jump to C. When you break it down to formulas, it's all so easy, isn't it?
Well, it's funny. I mean, Kilbourne, at the time that show was on, or he was on The Daily Show, I mean, it was so much such a meaner show, really sort of mean. And at the time, I was at the age of fuck everybody. This is awesome. And then I think most people sort of grow out of that. I think that's the problem. I think there's sort of, 40-year-old frat guys who I'm sure are still kind of like that. But now I'm at the point of why so mean? Why don't, why are we picking on people who don't really deserve it? There's enough deserving people in the world to pick on where it's why are we making fun of idiots?
Our next story isn't really a story. Oh. It's just something that I noticed that I felt needed to be called out. Mm-hmm. ABC.com decided they were going to do a story on the 30th anniversary of Caddyshack. And they were like, let's do a Where Are They Now?
Okay.
Ooh.
And they chose, the people who they chose to feature on the Where Are They Now were Bill Murray.
Where has he been, guys? Where has he been?
Chevy Chase.
Uh-huh.
Rodney Dangerfield. And Ted Knight. So
Dangerfield's really easy to track down.
Yeah, as is Ted Knight. Yeah, he's been in pretty much the same place for the last 15 years or whatever.
I mean, who needed that? It was just it's a 3-page article about it. And I was just we know. Yeah. We know where every one of those people are.
Really famous people and two dead people.
Yeah. I was there are other people in that movie. You could have.
In fact, I'm sure all the caddies. I mean, they never did that. That is actually a perfect. That's a great article of Where Are They Now, because I have no idea.
Right. That's why I clicked on it. I was I bet there's gonna be something where the guy who was a caddy is now he owns
a real caddy in real life.
He owns a golf course somewhere.
And he charges $10,000 to be caddied by him because he was in Caddyshack.
Yeah. I actually always felt bad for those actors just because the movie Caddyshack, unsurprisingly, is supposed to be about the caddies, and apparently there's hours of other material all about the caddies that all got cut out because when they wrote the movie, it wasn't Bill Murray and Chevy Chase, and then they came in and the studio was like, let's have more Bill Murray and Chevy Chase in this movie. Yeah. And then that's why if you watch that movie now, you're just wait, what's this plot with the caddy? His girlfriend's pregnant? What does this have to do with anything? Because it's two scenes in the movie.
Why are they ever talking to Chevy Chase?
Yeah. Crazy.
Right?
It's a Chevy Chase heavy show. I don't know how that happened. It wasn't intentional.
And our third story features your favorite, Dane Cook. Dane Cook.
That's sarcasm.
Yes, that is definitely curious. Sarcasm. Dane Cook, you recall his appearance on American Idol.
Mm-hmm.
He got interrupted during the show by Ian Bernardo. who said, you know, like, nobody cares about you. I'm going to be the next host of American Idol. Did you guys saw this?
Right, I saw that clip. Yeah.
Yeah. He is suing the show and all the people involved for $300 million.
Dan Cook is suing.
No.
Oh,
Ian Bernardo is suing American Idol and essentially Dane Cook and his manager.
Okay.
Because he says that Dane Cook and his manager shouted homophobic things, threatened to stick the microphone up his butt.
Okay.
And, you know, just taunted him and encouraged him to do the things that he did. And it embarrassed him.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt threatened. Mm-hmm. So they have to give him $300 million.
Mm.
Thoughts?
I mean, other than the fact that Ian Bernardo's name sounds like a villain from an 80s comedy, I don't know if I have. I mean, he's on American Idol. He clearly wants a lot of attention. He grabbed the microphone out of Dane Cook's hand to get attention, and now he wants more attention and $300 million. So, good for him.
I just find the thought of just like Dane Cook and his manager hanging out harassing a guy backstage at American Idol, it's like, maybe it happened, you know, but why? You know, like, it just strikes me as...
Well, I can see them being mad. I mean, being like, what the fuck? Why did you do that?
No, but they're saying before.
Before it happened. Before. Oh, I don't know then. I don't know. That seems unlikely, but...
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to tell you about that. Okay. Carl, any thoughts?
I don't... Why 300 million? I'd go 600 million. Yeah. I think 300 is selling yourself short.
Yeah.
For being called.
Shoot for the moon. Maybe you'll land among the stars.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a poster in my junior high gym said.
Yes, on a related note, I'm suing everyone in my high school for $1 billion.
Yeah.
There's that. And like, I've written things that I find embarrassing when I look back on them for, you know, various jobs. And I'm like, wow, I should just sue them for them making me write that. Like, that's just horrible.
Or just sue yourself.
Yeah. Oh.
This is a case against 25-year-old Carl.
25-year-old Carl. He was terrible.
Yeah. And you notice he's not here.
Yeah.
You notice he's not defending himself.
I should take myself to small claims court. And then 25-year-old Carl doesn't show up. But current Carl just wins by default.
And then you have to pay yourself.
Yeah, and then I have to write a check
But that's the other part of the problem is getting the sheriff to go to 25-year-old Carl's house and get him to give you the money.
God, 25-year-old Carl didn't even have what I could sue him for. So.
Oh, that poor guy.
I don't know. All right, so let's get into our topic.
All right. Well, our topic this week, I mean, Carl...
Is comedy.
Is comedy.
I love comedy.
Carl does a fantastic show, as I was saying, called Inside Joke, where he sits down with a comedian, and they talk about comedy and the comedian's career, what they've learned on the way to the stage where Carl's sitting.
It is great how they arrive in a basement.
Yeah.
After all their courageous work over the years.
They get a plastic chair.
Yeah. No. We get the good chairs there.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, we get good chairs. Yeah. We're not on plastic anymore.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's big time.
Yeah.
And if you've ever seen Inside the Actor's Studio, this is Inside the Actor's Studio for comedians.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to cry.
Somebody does cry.
Yeah.
I don't like... I've never seen Inside the Actor's Studio.
Oh, really?
Not to cut off your setup, but I've never seen it. And I like to...
stealing it, okay?
I know. Yeah.
Here's what you gotta do.
That's why we have you here, because we have James Lipton in the other room.
Oh, I'd love to meet him. I think he'd be great.
If you've never seen it, then this is what you should do. So let's say, for example, you have Chevy Chase on the show. So then what you do is you're like, oh, and then you're in a movie called Vacation. Can we meet Clark Griswold? Real quick,
can we talk to Clark?
Yeah, like that kind of thing. Where it's like, can we talk to whatever? He's got Al Pacino. Can we talk to Scarface for a minute? It's like, what is that?
That much I know of the show is he doesn't ask. He asked very open ended questions, and it's like, and then you worked with Carl, and then it's like, yes, Carl was great. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that about myself, but
you are great.
I'm not. I was at a loss for names, and luckily remember my own. But the but the they do that anyway when you talk to them, and it is great when you're sitting this arm's length away from them, and like Al Franken will drop into Stuart Smalley or something. Mm-hmm. I do get a little giddy. David Cross did a voice. He like grabbed his throat, and I honestly don't know how the hell he did it.
The pimp voice.
He does this crazy voice. Boy, he gets his voice. I can't even do it. And everybody I know who was there. and myself afterwards, we were all strangling ourselves all week trying to figure out how we pulled this voice off.
It is. It's like another human being. It really is.
Completely another human being.
That's awesome. Yeah. So let's talk about where did the idea for this show come from?
Sure. Well, it's not an amazing story, but I was writing for People Magazine. Actually, it's a story you can read in the book Rejected by John Friedman. I was writing for People Magazine and People.com, and they sent me out to do interviews with people, profiles. And I would get a lot of actors and actresses I did not care for at all. And I wasn't doing comedy at the time. And then The Daily Show came on, and it was Jon Stewart's first year hosting The Daily Show, and they were doing the Millennium Special. It was in December of 99. And so I pitched to People. I was like, look, you know, we should do this piece on Jon Stewart. And they were like, okay, great. So I got it set up, and I was there the night after Dole was there, Bob Dole. And in fact, I was waiting to meet with Jon in the dressing room, Bob Dole's room, and it was all still decked out for
all
Dole.
Doled out?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, hey.
What?
It was all doled out, totally, with whiskey. There was a bottle of whiskey there.
Well, empty bottles of whiskey.
Yeah,
many
like
empty.
Like a case, like I can drink in one hand. And the and so anyway, I did this piece with Jon, and People sent me out with two questions. They wanted to know how much money, or how does he feel about making $5 million or something like that, and when was he getting married? Those were the two questions that People wanted answered. And I should, like, you knew that from writing People pieces. They're very formulaic, and I had no interest in them, but it was money. And I said, Jon, I met him, and we were in his office, and I was like, Jon, People wants me to ask you these two questions, but I'm not going to ask them. I just said, like, what makes people laugh? And he was really quiet, and he was quiet for like a minute, and he said, it's sad you've asked me a question I don't know the answer to. And then we talked about that for a half hour. I had a half hour with him, and I left like really excited about it. And then wrote the piece, and People killed it, and they wouldn't run it. And that was the last thing I did with them. And
it's hard to believe a bastion of journalism like People Magazine.
I know
wouldn't run such a great article.
And it was a really good piece. And that interview is it's on the website, but the full interview. But the so from there, I started doing improv, and then I was like, wait a minute, now that I have a stage at my disposal, I think it'd be really cool to maybe get people up because I could learn something from them. And that's all I wanted to do. And they weren't questions. I know it gets a little nerdy there, and there's this E.B. White quote that's like, dissecting a joke is like dissecting a frog. The frog always dies and no one really cares. And I was like, I always had that in mind. And then I never wanted it to be an interview. I always wanted it to be a conversation about the craft of comedy. And so having never seen inside the actor studio, I always compared it to like This Old House and Charlie Rose without the interruptions or power tools. I know it's stupid, but for me, it was just sort of like, I'm not going to interrupt you. I really want to hear about how you build what you build. And it's inherently funny just because of who's on stage and because of what they've done. And it isn't like, you know, Chevy, you've worked with Bill Murray. Tell me what that's like. I don't necessarily care about that. I really want Chevy. How did you do what you did, or you know, whatever question I would ask. So that's where it came from, and it's going strong. I mean, it started in 2002. I think the first one was January 2002, and it was 50 seats. It was at Gotham City Improv, and it was with Lewis Black. And I thank everybody who's done it because everybody who said yes to do it, it's just been amazing that they give up a night and don't get any money for it and just sit and talk about their work. So, yeah, if you're listening, please come back.
I wonder how much of it in that vein is like, because you're amazed, like you said, you're amazed that there are these comedians who are out there and they're doing it and it's amazing. And you're like, please fill me with your knowledge. I wonder from their mindset if they're still like, you really want to know what I do? You know what I mean?
Because
like, if somebody asked you about like, how do you craft your comedy? You'd be like, why are you asking me that question?
Well, you can't. Yeah, you can't. It's interesting. I've finally learned how to talk about it, I think, from doing it. But you can't ask. It's like, how'd you come up with that joke? There's no answer to that. And
right.
It's like, again, who really cares? but it's sort of like they're you almost learn more about their through their struggle than about how they write a joke, because there are formulas. And John talked about that in that People interview. John Stewart talked about that in that People interview. And he's like, you know, there are formulas and all that stuff, but the in the clouds, he called that in the cloud shit, comes as rarely as it ever comes, you know, despite the fact that he'd been doing it for 20 years at that point.
We've talked a lot on this show about the need for something awful to have happened in your childhood in order to be a comedian, as sort of like a universal thing that we see running through it. But that's our experience. Is there anything that you've seen from talking to all these people that's a similar thing that carries throughout?
I guess, you know, some of them have real stories of, like, alienation. And I don't know everyone's backstory necessarily, but, like, Kevin MacDonald, who was on your podcast last year, I guess, he's got, like, a horrific, not, I wouldn't say it's horrific, but, you know, he talks about it in his show, too. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving anything away here. His dad was an alcoholic, and he was, you know, he wasn't particularly kind to those guys, and even when the kids in the hall started, he would call up and be like, "Les Blood, what's with all the queer stuff? Like all this stuff." You know, he would like taunt him on the phone, but Kevin is like an amazingly nice, you know, fairly grounded guy. But I don't know. You know, Al Franken had an incredible, just seemingly happy childhood. You know, all these, I can't say. And even just speaking from my own experience, I mean, I'm sure everybody goes through high school and takes crap from somebody. And then there are times when they don't take crap. I mean, the crap taking leveled out for me at some point. So,
yeah, I mean,
you're lucky.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you know, it's always like that sort of cliche of like, well, you know, a comedian, they probably have like an alcoholic dad or, you know, something bad happened to him. And it's like, yeah, it's true. There's also a lot of mechanics who probably have
right.
like an alcoholic dad
yeah.
or, you know, yeah. it's I don't know where it comes
no,
from.
No, but I agree that that's true, but still it's like they're not every mechanic had alcoholic dads, but
it is kind of uncanny.
Like my dad would hit. No, I'm kidding.
No, it is kind
he
of.
He doesn't listen.
It is.
I can
kind
say
of,
he did whatever he did.
Yeah, it is kind of uncanny. Like I mean, there are the random person or the random like really popular successful comedian who seems to have had a normal upbringing, but it's always like, you know, anytime there's like a feature on a comedian, it's like halfway through, it's like, oh, and then this was like the terrible. Like even I had no idea about Stephen Colbert. Like he
family?
Seemed to have such like a normal, you know, life or whatever. And then like two thirds of the way through, it was just like, oh yeah. And then his father and like two brothers were killed. And it was like, holy shit. Like what? I had, you know, it was just like, oh, okay. Now that this sort of explains it. Why, you know, cause I mean, to be a comedian, like you have to, you know, I mean, you gotta do crazy shit and to have that drive. I think that's the thing too. Like I'm sure there's a lot of comics who are, you know, had normal upbringings or whatever, but to have that drive to go through what you have to go through, you
yeah.
know, to, I mean, every comic probably has that story of like, yeah, I lived in my car for a year, you know, and just to not give up and to just to
right,
need
to
this, you know.
It. But I mean, it's like that for anybody that does, I don't want to say extracurricular, but when you're pushing beyond the 9 to 5,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I like sometimes I work because I write ads and stuff. You know, my day job is like 8 a.m., 9 a.m. to ?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of like, oh, God, now I got to go work yeah. or do something. And it's just that ability, I think, to overcome, which I'm not doing so well at these days. But because I'm very tired. But, you know, I feel like, to be honest, I feel more bitter after I started doing comedy than before. I almost thought before I was maybe a little more like happy-go-lucky. But now I'm like, God, why? Why do I still have this day job, and why does nobody care, and I look like an idiot in this photo, or I sound like an idiot on this podcast, mm-hmm. You know, and I grade myself a lot more than I ever used to when I just showed up in an office and was like, good day, at least I'll get paid next week, who cares?
Yeah.
And
well,
I've said a bunch of times where I was like, I wish I didn't want to do comedy so I could just go to my job, go 9 to 5, come home, play video games, and just feel good about it.
I think that's it. I mean, you've totally hit it. That's it. I mean, it is, and I know this is a feeling for me. It's that. I don't necessarily want to stand out on the subway, unless I used to do a lot of stuff with Improv Everywhere, but where you'd want to. But I don't want to stand out from anybody else in the subway, but at the same time, I don't want to be that person riding the subway every day. Mm-hmm. When I look around on the subway in the morning, and granted, I only go one stop, but I just think like, oh, these people look miserable, and I look equally miserable because I'm going to do something I don't necessarily want to do.
Right.
And I guess that's it. It's that desire to do what you want to do and stand out. Because I don't know anybody that does comedy that doesn't want to do it. It's not like you've been forced into a hard life of standing on stage and getting a room full of people to laugh at you, which yeah. all of us here know. To me, it's one of the greatest feelings ever when you get 100 people or 20 people or 900 people to laugh at you. It's just like, wow, that's incredible.
I mean, it is.
Don't make me do that again.
I wonder if Ben Stiller had that experience of where, like, it's the family business.
Yeah.
You're oh, yeah, maybe it's it. Like you're growing up, Stiller, to be.
Don't make me do it, Dad.
I want to be an accountant. Shut up. I mean, it is fun. It is not to sound too cliched or maudlin, but it is sort of like, I mean, it's like an addiction. Like once you get that first laugh, it's like, oh, I got to keep doing that. Yeah. And it's like every minute you're in an office. It's funny because like people who have like a normal day job, like go to work and it's, yeah, they come home and it's their free time. Where it's like every minute I'm in an office, I'm like, oh, I'm wasting time. Like I, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
I should be writing right now. And then when I get home and it's like, oh, now I got to start working. I've worked 8 hours and it's like, now I really got to start work because I wasted. What did I do? I wasted 8 hours working in an office today. Well, I'm an idiot. What did I do?
I hate getting paid.
It's terrible. Like, you know, I contributed to the American economy. What the hell is wrong with me? I should have been at home.
We need to take a break because we're 4 minutes over.
Oh.
We're going to go to break with a clip from Carl's show, from the most recent show as far as the most recent inside joke.
Yeah.
With Tom Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And Chevy Chase was there.
Chevy was there.
Yeah. All right. So here's a quick,
and on stage.
Yes. So here's a quick clip from that show. When we get back, we'll go through the whole list of comedians that Carl has spoken to on his amazing show and talk more about everything.
All right.
Bye. Great.
Tom, I read your book, 39 Years of Short-Term Memory Loss. For me, it's 300 pages of envious travels, stories, meetings. Even your downtime in that book is somehow amazingly exciting. I say this honestly. It's nothing I haven't said to you before. But one thing that came out of the book for me, just one thing, is the fact that like you never set out, you say it there, you never set out for greatness. But I feel like you really did achieve it. By page 287, I believe you achieved it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's
well,
our show.
That's all any writer wants to hear is that it was well crafted. Did you hear him say that?
I did. It's like
it sounded like it to me.
There's a beginning.
Yes.
And then you arc it. And then it ends.
Well,
you nailed it.
The book is partly about celebrity. And I am not a celebrity, but I know some famous people. And so I couldn't start out like Charlton Heston in his autobiography, where he starts out, I was born. So my first chapter is I went to Easter Island for Christmas with Dan Aykroyd and it turned into the Coneheads, right? So it's about sketch writing. Really, the book is a lot about sketch writing, and if that is something of interest to you, there's a lot about sketch writing in that book.
What's nice about that is every sketch requires several thousand dollars of travel to pull it off.
That doesn't include the bar tab.
No, and that's not even, you're right, that's not even including the bar tab.
That's right.
But
those are the old days. Now they do it on Ritalin and Krispy Kreme donuts.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't get the donuts up my nose.
Well,
I tried, everything went up my nose.
There's a lot of, I mean, it's an impressive array of substances that are name checked in this book. People, substances, and not name checked. I mean, what's nice about the people and the substances is you worked with them all.
I tried.
You had a very full life of the people and products that you knew. And I was
under the influence of some really wonderful people, too.
Yeah, no, and that comes across. It's said flippantly, but if you've read the book, I mean, it really does come across. You have this incredible friendship / brotherhood with a guy for 20 years, at least you have a partnership with Franken for 20 years. You have friendships that go on for 30 years in this book.
Mr. Chains is here tonight.
Yeah, Mr. Chains is here. I don't know who that is, but Mr. Chains is here.
You know.
There's just an incredible, it really is an incredible story, and I'm really at a loss for it because I've never read any story that's dynamic.
I was really motivated to write my memoir because I had some premonitions about my early death. And actually, it's turned out, a lot of my friends here tonight know that I've had cancer for 2 years, so I'm living with cancer right now. And I've told all my friends that, and I consider all of you here tonight, my audience, to be my friends, so I want to share that with you, that I've been living with cancer, and I'm not going to recover, but I had good news today. My new chemotherapy appears to be working well, but you know, I'm emaciated and my hair is falling out, so I thought that it would be a good idea. You know, some people come up and say, "Hey, Tom, you look great. You lost 50 pounds, your hair is falling out." I go, "It's the Nutrisystem. It's just, they deliver it to your door. You know, if you're serious about losing weight, you know, even lasagna." You know. But the fact is that, you know, I almost made a career out of other people's suffering and making fun of it. Franken and I did the brain tumor comedian once. You remember that? I wish I had it to show. I don't have it to show, but people with brain tumors wrote in saying that you guys are the greatest, and a few people sitting next to the brain tumor people wrote, "You guys are evil." But Al had a brain tumor, and he couldn't remember his jokes. So I hit him in the head, right in the tumor with a microphone. We would do things like that. So my life was filled with irony, and I think my death is going to be filled with irony as well.
Hey, and we're back with Carl Arnheider. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Real quick, so your show, Inside Joke, let's do this. This is not the full list, but this is a partial fantastic list of everyone you've had on your show. Louis Brack, David Cross, Dimitri Martin, Stephen Colbert, Chris Parnell, Mike Myers, Al Franken, Tom Davis, Kevin McDonald, Bob Odenkirk, John Hodgman, Dave Foley, Jonathan Katz, Alan Zweibel, Zach Galifianakis, Jenny Garofalo, Chevy Chase, and the Goot, Steve Guttenberg.
Oh, Steve Guttenberg, yeah.
These are all people that you've had on your show.
So the back half of the show is all going to be about the Steve Guttenberg.
Steve was great.
Oh, he seems like, I don't even know if I want to say the thing I'm going to say. I'll say this, because he was on, did you see him on Party Down?
No.
Okay. He has, I think wisely, because I think he is a pretty funny, talented guy.
He's very funny.
But he knows the score, and I think he's widely pulled a Shatner.
I could see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meaning he gets it, and I think it's a smart thing to do, to be like, okay, I'm in on it. Even if you aren't the happiest about what has happened to your career, just go, okay, I get it, and then just start doing that.
Yeah.
Because he played himself being a wacko, and being surprisingly like a nice, funny, but like clearly whacked out version of Steve Guttenberg on Party Down, and I was delighted to see it. I was like, oh, and he was hilarious, by the way. He was really, really funny.
He's got incredible timing.
Yeah,
yeah, he's great. I think Guttenberg I don't know why. I really don't know why Guttenberg is not. He, you know, I think a lot of people, and I've talked when that show's gone on, I talked about it. I like Tom Hanks replaced him in a way. Like he
what?
Yeah. Well, he
how?
Was, listen.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You're going to tell me you could have put Steve Guttenberg in Castaway and it would have worked?
No, I'm saying like they had the same kind of like wacky comedy roles. You know, like if you look at let's go back. You know, like Guttenberg could have been in Bosom Buddies or any of those roles. They were the same sort of person, and then Guttenberg sort of Started working on other projects, and Tom Hanks
tried to ride the police academy train as far as it would take him.
Well, he didn't. I mean, he jumped off.
Yeah, onto the three men and a baby train. I mean, it's not like he went that far.
Hey, I mean, at the time, you know, that thing was a juggernaut. I mean, you know, now it's somewhat forgotten, but
there's no Blade trilogy, people. Come on.
He's done five movies that grossed over $500 million or something like, or $100 million in theater. Like, he's done. First time he was the guy,
yeah,
and it's just sad to me that he's not the guy anymore because he's great,
yeah.
And he talked about it, he was like, look, I've been in some crappy projects and sometimes I just did it, and he was very honest about, like, yeah, I've done some crappy work and I can tell you how to get out of doing that.
Well, I mean, I think
how do you get out of doing that?
I don't remember, but he had the whole story.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the other thing too is people, you know, sort of beat up on actors, like, it's incredibly hard to, like, every time a job ends you have to get another job.
No, and I,
you know,
I,
what I mean, like, it's, I, but I think it was funny to me when people were just like, well, why is, like, actor X doing this thing? It's like, probably because that was the best thing he could get. Well, you know, I mean
draw the analogy to your own life. Yeah. Excuse me, I mean, I've had some incredibly bad jobs where I will work there for 2 years and be like, I had a job where I didn't even tell anybody where I worked.
Yeah.
Because I wrote for a horrible magazine. Everybody was like, oh, I was like, I write for a magazine.
Yeah. Dude, well, I did accounting for 3 years, all right?
So yeah, I mean, I've had really shitty jobs. They're just not public shitty jobs.
Right.
So it's not in Variety. Right. It's unfortunate.
The shitty magazine.
It is unfair. I mean, put it in perspective. Like, imagine if there was a magazine called, like, Everyday Person. And it was just sort of, and it was just stories about, like, Carl, who's writing for this god-awful magazine, which I still won't name, there's just, like, people like Steve Guttenberg sitting around going, like, why would you ever want to do that? I mean, yeah. What kind of asshole keeps that job?
Was it Swank?
No, Swank would have been better. I'd talk about that. At least there's a story there.
Yeah. I mean, I had an interview today for a job.
It's got to be Maxim.
I don't want this job. I wasn't like, you know, this job is really going to fulfill me. And means it's just like, I'd like them to not turn the cable off. You know what I mean?
Right. You need to get to tomorrow.
I need to make money.
But what I'm saying is that if you're Guttenberg could be Tom Hanks,
yeah,
were to hold true. I feel like Steve Guttenberg at some point should have gone, okay, you know what? There's an indie movie out there being made that's not going to get made unless it has a star. Let me star in your movie.
He's done that. Yeah.
It was called P.S. I Killed Your Cat. He writes stuff. He does indies. He just is not on. He's always shooting something. Every time we're in contact, he's like, I can't stay out late. I'm doing this thing tomorrow.
But did you see P.S. I Killed Your Cat?
I did.
How was it?
I mean, it's not his greatest work.
But he took it off the stage.
He actively went out to look for something.
Yeah, but you never know.
But that's another example of you don't know.
It's also hard to when you pick a movie, you might think it's going to be good, only to have it turn out to not be good.
But
you know
he
what
could
I mean?
Have been good in it.
Well, I wasn't knocking him in it.
I was saying, you know, it wasn't a great. Great
yeah.
movie.
And I mean, you know, look, Tom Hanks has got Joe versus the Volcano. I mean, not everything he's ever done has been. I just thought it had some serious story structure problems. We'll talk about it off mic. I mean, I liked it. But look, one of my favorite movies of all time is The Burbs. So you're not convincing me on Tom Hanks.
I didn't like.
All right, there we go. That'll be our point of contention later on. Let's get off Steve Guttenberg, as much as I love talking about it. Let's talk about Alan Zweibel.
That
is a great. A name most people don't know. In fact, I just pronounced it wrong, apparently. But, I mean, that is a guy who's been around forever and was one of the original SNL writers.
Yeah, he was one of the first writers hired for SNL. He was one of the first six guys, when they only had five or six. But I love, I'll just blow it out for a second. I love when I can get anybody from that era of Saturday Night Live because it was such a rich, very classic. I mean, not everything there is amazing when you go back and watch it. But I was three when that show started, four. So I certainly wasn't watching it. But yeah, he was great, and he's a great guy. When he did the show, unfortunately, it was like 8 degrees outside, and we definitely didn't have the audience that show deserved, but purely on not on name, because, you know, the show, I think people come because it's a unique show. And I mean, for certain guests, it's definitely heavier, but every show sells out. That show is 8 degrees that night. But Zwei Bell, yeah, legend, created a lot of great stuff, and just an amazing, amazing writer.
Well, I think that's amazing about that era of SNL, that first 5 years, that it's not something that you can manufacture or plan for. But when you watch those episodes now, there is a palpable like electricity and danger to this day. That just it feels like any second it's all going to come off the rails.
Right.
And the fact that it doesn't is just amazing. It is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And it feels like for the in the comedian world, it was like being on the first space shuttle. It was like,
oh yeah,
they landed on the moon.
Yeah, right. Those guys totally landed on the moon, and everybody else is just going back. Yeah.
And the funniest thing was at the time it was a show to replace like the Tonight Show, so it was kind of like you went to the moon. Only it was only like when you were 2/3 of the way there, did you realize you were on a rocket ship to the moon? You know what I mean? Like it could have been.
We've been on a rocket this whole time?
Yeah, it could have been like a forgotten little show, only to find out that, you know, not only are you on TV, but you're on like this incredibly popular show that's going to be, you know, 30 years later is still running, or more than that, 35 years now is still running, which is crazy. Is he also one of the guys who never left or left and came back? He's still there, right?
No, he's gone.
Oh, okay.
He left. I think that entire crew left after the first 5 years. They except for Chevy Chase, who bailed before everybody else, and not speaking as the show's historian, but they stayed to the end, and when it was over, they're like, "That's it. We're Lawrence people. We're out."
Right.
He didn't go back. Franken and Davis went back.
I know, like Jim Downey.
Mr. Mike aborted. Yeah, Jim Downey went back.
He's still there.
And Herb Sargent went back.
Yeah,
and left after a while. But yeah, Alan didn't go back that I remember. But he was, you know, he was Gilda's writing partner, Gilda Radner's writing partner, and he did the Gary Shandling show, with Larry David. No, with Gary Shandling. Yeah. And and he's doing. I forget what he's doing now. He's doing something now. He's out in LA doing something now.
We talked about this a little bit briefly off mic, but what do you think the difference is from speaking to these people between your average everyday comedian and your legend comedian? What makes them go to that legend status?
I honestly have to say, I still don't have an answer for that, but I can say. From talking to people, I still think everybody who's achieved legendary status, they do not think of themselves as being some sort of legend.
Okay.
And I think they're still as surprised by it as ever. Like Terry Jones did the show for Monty Python in at SF Sketchfest in January, and you know, just talking to him out to dinner afterwards, and even on stage, I think he said it. He was just like, "We were as surprised as anybody. We didn't think." And he would go there. And, you know, at the time, everybody was like, yeah, we're big fans of Monty Python, but whatever. But still, you know, now, 40 years later, it's sort of like, he's still like, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. But everybody who's around him is like, oh, my God, you're Terry Jones. So I almost think the difference between everyday comedian and legendary comedian is the way people are treated. And even is the way people treat them or the regards they hold them in. Even someone like... Lewis Black will talk freely about, like, I get a lot easier laughs now that I'm Lewis Black from The Daily Show than when I was Lewis Black, guy who was working at whatever the theater was he worked at. I can't think of it, in Midtown, where he was the manager downstairs. And by the way, the kids in the hall played there and knew him when he was the manager there, when they were in New York. So it's like, you know, he achieves some level of success, and then suddenly everybody's like, oh my God, Lewis Black is the funniest guy ever. But he could do that same joke 15 years ago, and people would be like, eh.
Who was it? I can't remember who it was. It was somebody routine, and then they showed it. It was the same routine like 10 years before. It was the same exact. Oh, it was Jimmy Fallon. No, it was Jimmy Fallon. Okay. Did like this thing of this list of impressions, trying to like sell a troll doll, I think. And they showed it like, you know, now that he's Jimmy Fallon, and it killed. And then they showed it when he was like starting out, and it got laughs. But it was clearly, you know, people were kind of like, oh, that's funny. And like, he would do the, you know, oh, now it's Al Pacino. And he would say like one word and the place would explode. And it's just, so, I mean, I think when you get to that point, you have to work on is not getting lazy.
Yeah.
It's staying hungry when it's like, all you have to do is, you know, say anything and the place is going to go nuts because they're just expecting, you know, you're already funny and famous. So obviously anything you say has got to be hilarious.
Yeah.
That's got to be a really tough thing to because I mean, fuck it.
You're resting on your laurels at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I would be resting on my laurels so hard.
You are now.
I know. And I've achieved jack shit.
I was going to say, I need to really work on not being lazy too. And I've not achieved pretty much anything.
You're on the podcast, man. That's huge.
I know. I think this is my second podcast of the year, guys.
Yeah.
This is going to be a good year for you.
Oh, wait. You're not. This isn't.
We had an
the only podcast I've done?
Yeah.
No, I did a friends podcast once.
This is a problem.
Yeah, well,
we have an exclusivity.
Yes, this is never going to see the light of day. Oh well.
Might as well
finish it.
We'll just keep going.
Look, I've screwed that up too.
I think someone else who would be great to talk to. I mean, you would know. You talked to him, Jonathan Katz.
Oh, he was great.
Yeah. What a singular mind that guy has.
He's
insane. He used to have I don't think he does anymore. He had a podcast where he did kind of like a sketchy thing. And it was just like the most like I tried to explain it to people and it was like listening to a dream. It was hilarious, but it was just like just to follow the logic of that guy's mind is like amazing.
He was great. And I was after him for a long time because he lives up in Massachusetts, but he would come down and I was like, please do this show. So it was really exciting for me because I was a big Dr. Katz fan. And my big memory of that show is he has MS, I believe. And he was just stretching out beforehand, really just trying to limber up. And he was great. But I still see that of him just like backstage on the crappy floor of the UCB's back room, which is... not always the cleanest, and he's just there like stretching, you know, his legs. I was like, oh, this poor guy. But and you know, he's just sort of lazing through it, and he was on something. He was like, I can't. He was taking whatever pill he said it slowed him down. So but he was great, and it's great to talk to him because I love talking to writers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a comedian on stage, but the writers are always good because they really, to talk to a writer about writing for me is like the ultimate nerd quest, and same thing with Zweibel and you know Tom Davis too, but yeah, Katz is great. I mean, I can't say anything more about him. I'm blanking on stats.
The best person I've ever heard talk about comedy is Stephen Colbert. He has all these theories about status. I mean, I saw a whole thing with him one time.
He's ultimate like status. Minutes. Yeah, yeah. He's high status but idiot.
And, right.
He's mastered that. He was great. I did love that show because he was a Daily Show correspondent at the time, but he really does talk. He talks comedy theory, and even more so than him, we did this show at UCBLA with Bob Odenkirk, and we never even got to Mr. Show or to Saturday Night Live. We were still in like Second City when we had to go, and I think we put in a little more than 90 minutes. And we never even got to the bulk of his work because he's just loaded with theory and he will talk about it till the audience falls asleep. But the both of those guys, I feel like just thrive on it and they understand it so well. And every night you can break the Colbert Report down and really see it. And, it was a true joy.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone who's been on stage has been a true joy, but to be on stage with Stephen Colbert was great. Because that mind works in a way that I am in absolute awe of, and at a speed that I can't imagine working at.
And those two guys clearly love it, you know, love comedy. And it's funny, we were talking about like legends. Like I think there's that, like a Stephen Colbert and a Bob Odenkirk who think about it a lot. And then there's other people who I think literally don't know how they do it.
Right.
Like, it just sort of comes to them.
Well, in that vein, then compare it to like a Zach Galifianakis. You know, like how was he theory wise?
I don't think we talk theory. Zach, what's great about when some people come on, they're just really honest about stuff and being like, I don't know how it happens. Zach would just talk like, you know, nobody cared about Zach, and Zach would just do like Hamburger Harry's in Times Square, and you know, that was his first show, and he just did his thing, and then suddenly
poor guy.
Suddenly, you know, I think he's
wow, I didn't,
so big right now.
Hamburger Harry's.
No, I was gonna say Zach Galifianakis and I have something in common because yeah. Hamburger Harry's is one of the first that I did when I came to New York.
And, yeah, right in
and
the
it
back.
It was a nightmare.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, and that's where he started.
Yeah.
And where are you now?
I loved you in The Hangover.
Thank you. Thank you. Nobody. Oh, people don't say that enough to me.
Well, and when you were saying like talking to a writer issue, like your nerd thing, to me, any comedian talking about comedy is my nerd thing. That's why we have this podcast, because we like comedians talking about nerd things. And so I will listen, like I will go to your shows and listen to you and comedians talk about things habitually. Part of what's fascinating about it, anytime you interview anyone, it's interesting because you're learning about another life. What I think is fascinating about comedians, at least for me, is that because in order to get where they got, they had to be more in touch with their emotions and their experiences.
Right.
Because they needed to translate them to other people in a way that they would understand them and sympathize. So it just seems like one of the best experiences you can have, but it's not out there anywhere. You're doing it. And I can't really name too many other people who are doing what you are doing with these types of people.
Oh, I can. I feel like everybody's done it a lot better than I have.
There should be a bunch of names coming to my mind immediately of like the famous person who does this. And there isn't, you know, and I wonder why we don't see it ever.
Probably because it's in theory incredibly boring. You know, I do think Inside Joke is a very funny show, and we were talking off mic that I think it's a comedy show before it's an interview show. It just interview happens to be the medium that we get the laughs from. But David Steinberg had a show, I think it was called Sit Down Comedy, on A&E, Bravo, something like that. And he did a show that was essentially... he was doing essentially the same thing I do, and it was with people like... Jerry Seinfeld did it, and everybody he's worked with, he's a director. There's a show on Sirius or XM, both of whom I talked to at some point, and then they did the show called Unfiltered. I don't know what it's called because I don't get either of them, but I think it's called Unfiltered, and they did it.
Oh, maybe Unmasked.
Unmasked, that's it. Yeah, Unmasked, yeah. So people are doing it. I just don't know that the audience is there for it.
I would think, from my point of view, I would think this would be fascinating, like, to people. I mean, you know, we also talked off mic about, you know, why isn't the show on TV, and, you know, it was pitched or whatever. I'm not going to get into that. But sort of the gatekeepers were like, no one's interested.
Yeah, nobody's interested.
Now, do we think that that's true, or are they wrong? Like, because I feel like you put this on Comedy Central, and it's gonna be great. I mean, people are going to love it, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm the crazy person. I don't know. Because, I mean, when I hear, you know, this kind of talk, it's awesome. I'd love to hear people talk about their craft. And I don't understand why we have Inside the Actor's Studio, they do with musicians. Why, like, comedians... You know, they're like, well, it's not funny.
Well, and Dave Chappelle is, I think, their highest rated show for that. I mean, he did like 2 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, like, it's sort of like, is it? Oh, well, the other thing, like when we do this show, we occasionally get people being like, well, your show is not funny enough. Now, first of all, it is funny. But second of all, it's like, well, we're also doing something else besides just doing comedy. I love the fact that you take it seriously, you know what I mean? Like trying to balance that and not just have it be like, well, let me just set you up to do a joke. Like, let's
we don't do that. We never talk before we go on stage. I never set them up. But I do. I mean, you've touched on something that I think is great. One, it took me forever to be comfortable out there, and to lose that. Oh my God, this is whoever sitting next to me. I'm like, hey man, what's going on? Let's go out there. And typically, that's how it goes. But you know, I started in improv, and building things with a group is still really great. And I don't do it anymore. It's still, I love that feeling, and that happens every show, where you just look. I mean, I can think of Dave Foley, where I just looked over at Dave, and we had that eye contact that improvisers have, and it was just like, okay, we're going. Yeah. And it was like completely unspoken, and we did this great I call it great, but you know, I had a lot of fun doing this thing with a Rice Krispie treat where we pass this back and forth, and then I wound up singing to his daughter. but it was just fun. We essentially made out over a Rice Krispie treat. That's how it ended. But just building these things is incredible. And we talked about David Cross before. I remember we ran off stage in that show and we were backstage and he was like, "Oh, I got my notebook," and we ran off and I think he unzipped a bag or he unzipped something, and the audience laughed from that. And I remember almost like hitting him on the shoulder like this and going like, "We should do a bit.
Right.
We should totally do a bit right now." And, but I didn't say anything. And I was like, it would have been the stupidest thing I could have ever possibly done in my life.
Yeah.
Because it's an unspoken build, and just because of who's doing it. And, because of my now matured, approach to things, you know, these things really come to life. So it's great to see. And it's, you know, everybody's got it, you know, everybody's got that ability. So
it's great. All right. Well, I think unfortunately we are out of time. I don't want to go. I blabbered.
I'm sorry.
No, you did great. All right. So if people want to find out more information about the show, you can check out inside-joke.com.
That is correct. Just re-registered it today.
Nice. When we were registering our URL, I accidentally registered till 2014. So we have to keep doing it.
Oh, no. Yeah, 9,000 Dustin, podcasts. The world's going to end in 2012.
Oh,
you're
born
2 years for no reason. Oh, by the way,
I wasted $29.
I did see a video clip of these people who are preparing for the end of the world. It's like this crazy family. And the husband and wife were preparing for the end of the world in 2012. And they were like, "Oh, and the other great thing we do, because we're using our noodle, is we buy a lot of things on credit that you don't have to pay for 2 years. Because there's going to be no one around to collect." So we got they had a big screen TV and like all this shit. And I was just like, "Oh God, you."
Somebody bought a billboard that said the world is ending May 21st, 2011.
All right.
It's going to be so weird to repossess their bomb shelter. that's going to be really awkward. I can't wait for that repo special.
I also wanted just their explanation in court of just being like, "But we thought the world was going to end. Your Honor. Did you see the movie with Cusack when he's running and the ice is coming and then he's driving the limo?" I mean, I really thought that was going to happen. So please give me my TV back.
Well, I wonder if they're like, "Yeah, remember how in that movie the world didn't end? There was just a lot of water."
Yeah. Remember that it was just a movie?
Look, Your Honor, I cut it. I mean, I stopped watching 2/3 of the way through. It was pretty bad. But I thought, hey, I could buy a lot of things on credit.
And I thought, I only have 2 more years. I'm not going to finish watching this. I got other shit I got to do.
I got to learn how to fire a rifle.
I only went to college and took out those loans because I thought the world was ending in 2012.
I should not have. Why did I even need higher education at that point?
I'm going to say that, Carl, thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me.
I'm also going to extend it on tape so it's official anytime you want to come back and talk about comedy stuff. You're more than welcome.
I mean, call ahead because sometimes guys, I'm not here.
Anytime.
So.
Seriously, we will post a link to your website on our website. Anytime you're doing the show, I'm just talking to the audience. Anytime you hear about the show, you got to go. You got to go see the show. It is fantastic. It always sells out within minutes, so be on top of that. But, you know, if you can get in, believe me. I mean, the one with Tom Davis, it was one of the best things I've seen in forever. And I love that he showed the sketches, you know, the sketches I wouldn't have thought, the sketches that he would have shown, you know, his favorite sketches were just fantastic.
Tom's the best.
Rumor has it the next show is going to be Cosby and Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Talking about the state of comedy.
Yeah.
So
playing each other. Yeah. Chris Rock is playing the Cosby role.
Awesome. Well, Carl, thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
For being on the show.
Comedy Nerds Forever.
Oh, yes. Stop it. I'm Dan McInerney.
I'm Destiny Dan.
Thank you guys so much for listening. We'll be back next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Comedy Nerds. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at info@thecomedynerds.com. Check out our website at thecomedynerds.com where you can comment on any past episodes. And if you enjoyed this show, please write a review in iTunes and tell the world how awesome we are. For Dustin and myself, thank you for listening.